And I do think AI is exciting. I just don't think that AI that we should fear it. And I don't think that we're going to wake up 3 days from now and have our entire lives upended and half of us losing our jobs. You know, I really think that to your point, it's going to be, how do I make meaningful steps forward using this new technology in a way that it augments me today? And I'm going to learn from that iteration. And as I learn, and learning being the most important thing in life, right? And learning being a CAGR or a compounding effect thing, that we as a provider will learn through telemetry and what users are getting value from. Users will learn from capabilities that we give them to keep pushing the envelope. I find that super exciting because I think it's an almost limitless set of like permutations of opportunities in front of us.
Yeah, by the way, I'm with you on not seeing a dystopian future ahead of us. I mean, I've always been an eternal optimist. Satish knows this. And anytime people are surprised by that, like, if I wasn't an optimist, do you really think I would have started a company? Do you think we would have started a company? Like, yeah.
Good point.
So yeah, I'm with you there.
Welcome to the Data Tea, our monthly podcast on the news, trends, and technology transforming data today. We're your hosts, Armand Petrosian and Satish Jayanthi, the co-founders of Coalesce. Let's get started.
Let's do this. Mike, such a great pleasure to have you on the Data Tea today. I've been really looking forward to this conversation. Before we jump into it, I got a bunch of questions that I'm curious about for you. Just a quick intro. My name is Armand Petrosian. I'm the CEO, co-founder of Coalesce. And then I've also got Satish here if you want to do a quick intro. And then Mike, we'd just love for you to give a quick background on your title, your role, everything around Sigma. So Satish, over to you and then to Mike.
Yeah, hey guys, I'm Satish Jayanthi, CTO, co-founder. Mike, I'm excited to be here to talk to you.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here. I'm so glad to be here. I actually took this while I was on vacation. Mike Palmer, I'm the CEO of Sigma. We span a couple of categories ranging from what we consider to be next generation BI, but all the way through the ability to build AI-driven apps. So there's a lot to cover, I think, you know, in terms of, at least from our view, customer value and where the industry is going.
Yeah, I'm excited. I got quite a few questions about Sigma in general and the product. Before we do jump into that, I would love to hear a little bit more about your journey and how you got into the role there at Sigma, because I met Rob, I met some of the co-founders of Sigma. He was a great guest, by the way. Did an excellent job. One of my favorites. But it's always interesting to me, you know, there's the whole Sutter Hill background of very commonly having some founders that are very smart incubating a product and then bringing in an external CEO. You saw that with Snowflake and the success that they had. And so they brought you in. They brought you in for a reason. But I was looking at your background and it looked like your career spanned a couple different roles that you know, I don't think are super similar. Like you went from being a chief marketing officer at one point to chief product officer. You know, I've seen that a couple times, but it's pretty rare. So could you just talk us through a little bit about how you got into the position you're at today and that entire path?
You know, the funny thing is every time I get asked this question, I realize I really should ask this question of Spicer, but I never have because I was always felt so lucky. I didn't really want to, like, you know, push it. You know, I can say this much, that Mike and Sutter Hill are very product focused people. So if there was anything that you should read into my history, it's product. And the last few roles being a chief product officer, whether that, you know, was in old school software or in SaaS delivered services, or as more of a GM role even before that, you know, it's where my passion is. It's where all the leverage is in building a business is having a great product. So I would say that's probably the most relevant experience. I also tend to describe myself a little bit like a foreman in construction terms. As you described, I've kind of done a lot of different things. And I think of a foreman as someone that's done some electrical, some plumbing, some carpentry. You know, you're not really good at anything, but you're okay at a lot of stuff, which helps as a CEO. I don't know, Armand, if you feel the same way. You know, I think those are the way that I think about my history a priori, if you will, to Sigma. Those are the two ways that I think about it.
Yeah, that makes sense. I do feel similarly. I think Satish, I'm fortunate to have him as my co-founder and partner. He takes on a lot of the R&D product engineering side of the business, but I do understand how to speak that language and of course the concept of our product, the value proposition. Meanwhile, predominantly focus on some of the go-to-market areas. For you coming in externally, not being one of the founders, that's always something that's been interesting to me because it feels like such a different role and it can bring different strengths and different challenges. And so I love diving deeper into that. And I'm sure they saw something really special in you when they did bring you in to run Sigma. It's obviously been a very successful business. And so I'm curious, given you came in externally throughout your career, although you've touched a lot of different areas within businesses in the past, was there a certain moment or a certain part of your career where you felt like it was most formative to the success that you've been able to bring as a CEO to Sigma?
That's a great question. I think there were almost two moments. One of them was at Sigma, actually. Before that, despite having a lot of different experiences, I almost have to go all the way back to two things that for me felt like the most formative. The first was, I don't know if you saw this in my resume, but actually it was a high school teacher for 2 years.
I love
I taught not the typical path, right? And it was
that.
in this program called Teach for America.
Oh, yeah.
It is an amazing program. I would tell you it's the fastest on the job learning that anyone will do. Like if you have the experience of every single day having to show up at an exact time, right? Because school always starts at one time. People show up a little late to meetings and sometimes they work from home. Like at school, you have to be there at one time every single day, right? And it ends at a certain time. And teaching kids class after class, holding their attention, preventing the worst from happening, also trying to inspire them to learn something, frankly, is maybe the hardest job I've ever had. You learn how to present, you learn how to prepare. There's a discipline about the entire experience. I would tell you, like, there's just nothing as formative as that for me. But at the same time, I would also tell you a story about Zuma, which was the first startup I went to. And this was right in that, 1997 to 2000 timeframe. So, what we used to call the dot-com era, maybe we still do, where that company went out of business. And there is a ton to be learned when you're going through that experience. You learn a lot about how much money it takes to build a business. You learn a lot about the sort of decisions that you can make, but you can't make at certain times. About how to recruit people and maintain, a great talent pool. There's just another like that dot-com era was another one of those. Learn a whole lot in a very short period of time. And even in that case, it wasn't successful, but the learnings for me, stayed with me for the, until now.
That's amazing. Yeah, I'm very familiar with the Teach for America program. I've had numerous friends that have gone through that, and they don't typically put you in the best areas with the most resources. And so you're really in a chaotic school environment, and they drop usually people that are right out of college into those environments, and they have to figure it all out. So I've got a lot of respect for anybody who's done those 2 years. It seems like a really great experience, but also a very challenging one, from what I understand. I
Yeah.
coached high school lacrosse, so I'm sure as a somebody from upstate New York, you're familiar with that sport. And that was
Very.
enough for me. It was very rewarding, super fun, but it's a lot to deal with young adults or children of any age. So
Yeah.
it was a fun experience.
Well, let's pull that one through just a little bit more. So first of all, I'm in my like 20th year coaching girls soccer, where I also coached the
Nice.
varsity team when I was at that school. And yes, big lacrosse player, my first
I love
ACL blown, upstate New York at
that.
Liverpool High School.
Yeah, yep.
but to your point about Teach for America, and then I'm just going to bring this directly to what it's like for all of us that are building companies. Isn't that the way it feels like when you're building a company? Here you go. You don't really have a lot of resources. Nothing is built. You have to go find people to do it. You have to fill in the gaps when there is no available resource because things still need to be done. There's a lot of that sort of MacGyver, if you remember the TV show, that
Yeah.
that you learn in teaching that is absolutely applicable to running businesses.
I couldn't agree more. I think some of the best leadership skills I gained was out coaching on the lacrosse field. And in fact, a couple of the players that I used to coach actually now work here at Coalesce, which is so awesome.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah. So it's been a really rewarding experience. And yeah, I mean, so many different challenges that you go through, whether it's communications, leadership, inspiring others. You know, that's one of our core values here at Coalesce. And you go through that all, especially with such a raw young energy that is very impressionable and earning their respect, winning the locker room. It sounds like you've gone through the same thing coaching women's soccer. So that's really cool. I love to hear it. And, you know, I've got one other question before I pass it to Satish, which I'm sure you've got some questions around the tech, but I am curious, you know, as you've gone through the career that you've had, I'm sure there was something that drew you to Sigma instead of the other way around. Like, obviously they probably reached out to you for this role, or you were going through the process of finding your next role. But what was it in particular that you saw in Sigma when you joined? Because it was a really interesting time. I think it was right before the pandemic or right after the pandemic started. And so I think they were much earlier stage at that point. And really they've hit an awesome inflection point. So like, what gave you the right signals to say, hey, this is a company worth going to, and I'm going to take a crack at it?
It's a great question. And I was not looking back at that time. So I was, I mean, a super, as I said before, super lucky to be, you know, to get that call. There were a couple of things that drew me to Sigma when I, even within the first 30 minutes of looking into the opportunity. For me, it always starts with people, and the people in and around the company are absolutely the best of the best. You mentioned Rob on, you know, coming on to do this. He's an amazing human being. He is thoughtful. He is smart. People like working with him and around him. Jason is also the other co-founder, Jason Franz, just amazingly sharp. That holds everything to a very, very high standard. And these were two qualities that it didn't take more than 10 minutes to discover from them when you met them. Mike Spicer, I mentioned earlier, from Sutter Hill, obviously with Snowflake and Pure Storage and a number of other companies. Sutter Hill itself is maybe the oldest venture capital firm in the Valley. Altimeter with Brad Gerstner was already involved. Like, you looked at every place you looked from a people angle, this was, you know, the team that you just had to look at and think, like, how does this team not succeed? Like, they, you know, it was more like, what am I going to do to help this team? They're already amazing people. On the tech side, it was a different point of view in the sense that this is one of the major decisions we made. The product, you know, wasn't there, but the market definitely was. If you think about the stat that I, working in and around infrastructure that I knew quite well, was that as customers were adopting AWS, there was a negative 65% CAGR to storing a terabyte of data in AWS for many years in a row, right? Mm-hmm. So you don't have to be like an economics major, you know, to understand if the price is going to go down, the volume is going to go up. And so you have this sort of amassing data, and Snowflake, obviously, was clear like where that was going. So you had the tons of data and you had the ability now to organize it. So the question on the table on that next layer of the stack was going to be, who was going to benefit? Was it going to be an infrastructure transformation where, you know, database engineers and cloud ops people cared? Or was it going to be an end user transformation where all of this data is now available, you know, in a cloud and an internet format so that it's more accessible to where, you know, if you compare it to our old school sort of private data center deployments, it just needed like the application UI layer. And that was blindingly obvious, you know, to me that that was going to be the next step. It was obvious that these people were the ones that could do it. I was just hoping that I would be able to help. And maybe to end this part of the story, I would say this, the first decision that Rob and Jason and I made together 1 month after I started was basically to shut down the product altogether, not put any more features into it, and rewrite it from scratch. And that was the most important decision we ever made.
Wow. That's awesome. Satish, anything you're curious about on your side?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll go to the main question that I always get and I keep thinking about, which is, how is the analytics space is changing, or is it going to be in a couple of years from now, or you know, because of the AI and all the stuff that's happening? How does that impact? How do like people build analytics moving forward?
That's a great question. And it's tough in some respects. It's a great opportunity working in this AI era, and it's tough in some respects because you have this what if, right? And it's a bunch of imagination in some ways, where no one knows what the answer is going to be. They're pretty sure something is going to be different. So this is putting my product hat on, right? I think about things more like what was the job to be done, as opposed to what is the category or what is the product. And here's where I start with, I think BI is frankly a terrible category and one whose time is basically over. Because it's not really the job that people were doing. People weren't trying to, you know, for example, look at a chart or God forbid, get an insight. Like that's a whole rant for later. The job typically is some sort of action taking, right? If you look at the data, you want to, I don't know, order more inventory, right? Or change your marketing strategy or hire more salespeople. It's always the doing part that we get paid for. And BI was always like the sort of the question and research part. It wasn't even the decision part to do something, because typically that comes with forecasting. Mm-hmm. So its category had to be sort of combined with other categories before value was generated. So I really do believe that AI is forcing us to rethink the value of each one of these categories. And what I think is going to happen is that we're going to see multiple categories get jammed together, and AI is going to fuel some of that in terms of eliminating, let's say, some technical barriers for users. Make it more efficient. But I don't know. I don't have all the answers. I can tell you what our strategy of doing, pursuing that is. I will admit, the future, what is Casey Stengel saying? I don't predict the future, but I know things are going to change categorically from where we're coming from.
Yeah, that makes sense. We are in firm alignment with the consolidation of the data stack. And we recently made a cross-category acquisition for a data catalog, which actually integrates nicely with Sigma. And we see that's going to continue. I think that that's only going to continue to happen, whether it's new functionality being unlocked by specific vendors that typically wouldn't have went to adjacent areas, or companies getting acquired or merging to have a more complete platform and solution. I do want to pull on the thread a little bit. I saw you cringe a little when you said insights. How do you feel about that word, Mike, in general?
This is the word that I would sort of strike from vocabulary. And here's where I have to make an admission. It's on the homepage of our website. And why is that, right? It's because like search indexing rules the world in marketing. So it's a tyranny. But mm-hmm. I have a real like allergic reaction to what I refer to as Dilbert words. If you remember the Scott Adams cartoon.
Of course.
My definition of Dilbert is, if I can walk into any company and use a word and have it mean generally the same thing, it's not specific enough to have real meaning, then I just can't use it, right? And insights is one of those things for me. I don't even know what an insight really is. Like I can get it from sort of the dictionary, but I come back to, it's not specific enough for me to really grab on and understand what value you're bringing to me and how you're doing that. So I find it to be one of those terms, like, another one is democratization, where I just have read about it for so long that I've become sort of just allergic to hearing it one more time.
If it makes you feel any better, we're guilty of using that one as well, as far as democratization goes when it comes to data engineering. It can be overplayed, feel overplayed, but then for lack of better terms, you end up using it or it's on your homepage. Is there any other, do you have any other contrarian opinions right now? Any hot takes that come to mind when you're talking to people in the market, talking to investors, talking to the team?
Maybe coming back a little bit to AI and a little bit to apps, the two we're making kind of two bets. You know, one bet, and my most strongly held belief is that, and let me pause and say this: when you get a little bit older, I just turned 52. That I always tell everybody there are two things that you have that other people don't. One of them typically is network, right? You've met a lot of people. And then the second is pattern matching. Like you've seen things come and go. And one question you always ask yourself is like, does this look like anything I've seen before? So, you know, on the pattern side, there are two patterns that I'm bothered by, if you will. One I think is a huge opportunity. We've done a lot of consolidation in the infrastructure part of the stack, by which I mean, we used to buy all these name brand storage and compute pieces of hardware in our private data centers. And that's become like completely fungible inside of like platforms like AWS and GCP and so forth. And that same thing is now happening, albeit I don't think as consolidated as people believe, with Snowflake and Databricks and the like. And when we did that, we still moved all of our applications almost on a like-for-like basis from the private data center to the public cloud. So you have all of these departmental applications in the same way you would have built them 15 years ago. And I think that we're about to move into an app consolidation era. And I do think that 3 or 4 years from now, we aren't going to be living in a world where we identify a workflow and buy a product for it, and then we just add it to like the, you know, 50 to 100 applications that the average enterprise is paying for. I think we're going to get down, you know, into like the 20 application range. We can go further in that if you'd like. The other one is on just AI in general, is where people have this belief that everything is going to change tomorrow. And maybe I'm cynical, but I sort of feel like technology changes quickly. Products change more slowly and people change really slowly, you know, and that I think it's going to take us a while to work out how AI really is materially valuable for us in our jobs, and that products then facilitate that value. We've had obviously a huge change on the technology side, but my contrarian view is that while all of that technology is changing quickly, I still think it's going to take longer than people believe to show up in our sort of everyday existence.
Yeah, I think just the behavior change, the shift is so dramatic that it's going to take a while for people to truly adopt the way that AI intends them to work. And I'll admit, you know, even I've been guilty of not being able to embrace AI as quickly as I would like to personally. And so
yeah,
I can't imagine what it's like for everybody else that goes through a similar type of experience when it comes to paradigm shift. Not to mention, it's still changing so quickly. It's hard to know what's going to stick and what's not. I do want to ask you. You go ahead, Satish. You're going to
say something. I was just going to add one thing there. Speaking of patterns, in a cloud was the same way. When cloud came in, people were resistant to move their data to cloud, and it took so long for people to embrace it and see the power. Same thing would happen. So, speaking of being 50s and seeing the patterns, I totally relate to that. Yeah.
And Satish, I'm sure you've seen this as well. I mean, it was not more than a couple of months ago that I was sitting in a meeting with a large banking person who was telling me, we were literally having, will I move my data to the cloud conversation?
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I was going to say. It's still happening. There's still resistance.
Yeah.
Especially for large financial companies, highly regulated industries, or international markets are still largely on premise. Like, still feels very, very early for cloud adoption, let alone AI. And everybody's talking about AI. And
that's right.
So, on your first point, like you mentioned that you see the, I don't know if it's vendor fatigue necessarily, or if it's just, you know, bigger companies, behemoths getting stronger for the consolidation of technologies, or maybe it's AI, the impetus for consolidation. Like what makes you feel strongly that, you know, enterprise will go from 50 to 100 technologies down to 15 to 20? What is that driving force?
I think the driving force is the underlying stack being consolidated. So if you think about purchasing an application, including a SaaS-based application, you're almost always purchasing a three-tier application. And where those tiers have consolidated, I think it's created better opportunities right above that for focus, right? So in an application world, you know, one of the things that most enterprises struggle with is they're buying, in effect, a schema and a workflow that they have to adopt. One of the life lessons that, well, life lessons, but one of the enterprise sort of lessons that I learned a long time ago, I worked sort of for a hot minute for Anderson Consulting. This was, you know, the pre-Accenture world. And yeah, the number one systems integration practice was SAP. And everyone just sort of took for granted, like, SAP is a difficult to deploy product and required a lot of customization, until Salesforce became the number one practice. And this was kind of like, well, wait a minute, Salesforce. It's called Salesforce. It's for a Salesforce. It was supposed to be an out of the box, if you will. I know it was cloud, right? Deployable workflow. And yet they're like, they've built globally their largest practice customizing it. And you think about, okay, how many applications today are companies adopting to a fraction of what the application provider thought that they would, or where they got a fraction of the actual value they thought they were going to get because their business is not like everyone else's business? And that almost always roots itself in the database, because it's what data and what schema the workflow can be built off of. So if we think about the world now as these consolidated databases like Snowflake and Databricks, where all the tables are there, the unlock is now, well, wait a minute, if we have the database, then we can build whatever custom workflows we want. And I think we're about to move into what I'll just refer to as like a platform-oriented application environment, as opposed to a best-of-breed three-tier application environment.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny because I, you know, I've been working, both Satish and I, we've been working with Snowflake for a very long time, probably since they were sub 100 employees. And wow, it's so crazy to see how the market has shifted from, at that point, as they were emerging and growing very quickly, the partner ecosystem has always been very strong for Snowflake, but there was just an endless amount of partners. Whereas now you've got, after several years, customers who want to reduce the amount of vendors they work with, because there was a point solution for every single part of the analytics workflow, and arguably over unbundled, if that's a word. It just went way too broad, and there was a lot of money that was pumped into some of these companies that probably shouldn't have been standalone solutions in the first place. And so yeah, I think we're starting to see the repercussions or the results of that now, you know, several years later after ZIRP and the pandemonium of fundraising in 2021. I agree. I'm curious to see how it continues to evolve, and I definitely see the platforms continuing to have broader and broader solutions as well for their customers, which is great. And, you know, similar to pattern matching, Satish and I talk about this all the time, but Oracle and Microsoft went through the exact same journey. There was a point where Oracle had a really strong database, and then they started to add on ways to ingest data and BI and all these other components. And so Snowflake and Databricks seem like the next generation version of that hyper competition. And we're here for it. So,
well, I'll give you another free hot take on that one, which is, and I challenge everybody with this. It's a really interesting couple of examples, right? Is how many infrastructure companies have built good end user applications?
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Microsoft's a great example, right? They are an end user application company. Their cloud platform is many times more expensive than AWS to use. Mm-hmm. They have failed continuously to release an enterprise scale database like Snowflake. And I think the reverse is true. I don't really see large scale infrastructure companies, and here I'll use AWS, building highly adopted, great user experience and user applications.
Yeah.
So I still feel like there's a little bit of a, almost like a law of nature component to, are you great at scale? Right, or you get great at end user experiences. We'll see how this plays out, because it's, as you said, this is where the market competition is happening right now. Do you buy a multi-layer value proposition from Snowflake or Databricks, for example, or mm-hmm. do you disaggregate those things and buy them separately? There's going to be an interesting competition out there over the next few years on that level.
Yeah. Yeah, the hyperscalers definitely, I think the most common thing they'll compromise is like the user experience, automation, some of the value props for specific parts of the workflow, but they've got the whole infrastructure to be hosted. So they're still winning in some regards. It's just not necessarily at the end user layer or something that brings the consumer the best experience for whatever relative part of the stack that they're proposing. But it's something that makes room for categories like us, both Sigma and Coalesce, to go and build a great value prop and make customers' lives way easier. So
that's right.
It's all good at the end of the day. Any other trends or predictions that you have been hearing lately that you disagree with that either show up on your desk or in your laptop that come to mind?
If I come back to AI, like one of the, again, patterns over time is that new technology just tends to expand the pie, right? It doesn't replace things. We have text and email and we can talk over the phone. And I think the reality is that, we've just done more communication over time, right? One has not necessarily completely replaced another one. So I sort of feel the same way about natural language. I am not a believer that natural language is going to replace the various techniques that we have to do our work. I think it's going to add and augment. I think there are various cases where natural language is a superior way to do something, but I also think there are many examples where it's not. So I am not one of those people that's kind of all in that language is the solution to efficiency for everybody over the long term.
Yeah, so that's like people just prompting their way through their life, basically, and I don't know if text to SQL comes to mind or any of those types of use cases. You feel like, sure, those things will be helpful, but they're not going to radically shift somebody's life or day job or their skill set.
Yeah. Text to SQL, I harbor a particular disdain for, actually, because in the end, it's still forcing you to have the mental construct of SQL.
Right.
So you've said it, but I mean, if you can do you have to almost understand what a SQL statement is, like in the first place. And if you don't have any of that understanding, then the efficacy of the method is just really poor. When I think about data specifically, I think natural language is really, really good at discovery, like where you guys are. Like, I think that idea that I know what data I'm looking for, but I don't really know how to articulate that from the point of view of a select statement. I think that's going to help a ton of people. Do I think, though, for example, that once I've discovered some data, or let's say I want to build a forecast model, that I want to speak all of that, to a chatbot and tell it, I don't know, take this, move it over here, add this variable, forecast this growth rate. Like, I think that's unlikely, like in my mind. So text to SQL is definitely a part of that. But I think there's a much bigger conversation out there, which is, are we evolving toward technologies where 100% of the way we do anything is going to be through words? Or does natural language augment what we're doing on a daily basis alongside other techniques?
Yeah, I definitely feel like, if anything, the way I view the analytics workflow evolving is that the data team and data people are still going to be very necessary, if not even more necessary. They'll just be able to do a lot more. They'll just be able to get a lot more done, ideally. But for somebody to prompt their way into forecasting without any understanding of SQL or comprehension of it, that's pretty scary, because there's probably going to be quality errors or errors just in general with the code that's being generated. And so it will still require somebody who can understand data architecture and be able to diagnose and solve problems. They just might be a lot more efficient, which is a good thing. We've always been focused on automation. So
I totally agree with you. I think that data engineers in particular are going to see broader remits than they've had in the past. If I were a data engineer today, that's what I would be thinking about, is not so much, the past 10 years of kind of ETLing data and data modeling, but actually thinking way beyond that. And then on the end user side, I'll give you an example from Sigma that really makes me kind of believe these things, is we built some capabilities in the product to build applications. And within like a year, thousands of applications have been built, but they for the vast majority of these applications, they weren't replacing any. They were net new.
Yeah.
And so when you think about technology and this idea of the expanding pie, you know, and not being a zero-sum game, I still think we're, you know, in a world of massive productivity gain opportunity. And most people even understand themselves that there is opportunity to, for example, create automations or find and use data. But the barrier, or the hurdle rate, as I call it, is still too high. And when you bring it down, just like the law of economics that we talked about at the beginning, right, you're just going to get more of it. And that's, for me, the opportunity going forward is not thinking about, is AI going to replace X? It's more, is AI or any technique, is AI going to expand the amount that I can do at any given time? I also just think it's a healthier way to think about like adoption and investment and so forth.
Yeah, I've got a couple more questions on the Sigma side too. So it just, as you were talking, it reminded me, one of our joint customers is a company called Audit Board, and they do, I remember them purchasing Sigma specifically for an embedded use case. And I'm curious, does that commonly have application use cases as well? So when people go through an embedded use case with Sigma, is that a good scenario where you see them building out applications with Sigma as well? Or like, where do you see that trend typically?
Absolutely. So I think, you know, when a lot of people think about embeds, they just think about externalized dashboards.
Exactly.
The way that we think about embed is going to replace, in effect, in the end, the file-based transfer system that most companies operate between each other. If you communicate with another company, it's inevitably in some sort of file transfer, right? You are emailing a file, you're SFTPing a file, right? You're doing some sort of file share. So the inefficiency of intercompany collaboration is significant. So when we think about embeds, it's not just us saying, hey, we've got a bunch of data and we'd like to make it available for you to see. We also want to get data from you. And because we got data from you, we can create a dynamic interaction. And that ultimately is the definition of an application. So for us, again, it's not, you know, this is again an example of expanding the category, right? It's, if you think about embeds like a BI category, there's very limited value. If you think about it as the ability to collect information as well as share and then take actions on those things, all of a sudden there's an interactivity, there's a productivity opportunity. So for us, you know, we're really pursuing that kind of bigger change.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm glad to hear it. I agree. I mean, I think just BI alone, people could argue is a very crowded space, but it's evolving in the way that Sigma's approaching it into something that's a lot more complete, a lot more interactive, and just in general, a lot more valuable. So that makes a ton of sense. What about the direction of Sigma? So you talked a little bit about it. Like, what are you most excited about in the next 2 or 3 years, whether it's your roadmap, whether it's the business? Like, talk to us a little bit about the future of Sigma and what's getting you excited every morning when you wake up about the business.
So we started out to be a product that everyone uses, right? We didn't want to build, and I'll credit Rob and Jason long before I started the company, didn't want to build another technical product for another technical person. You know, and Silicon Valley has had a history of doing that. So one of the things that excites me is just to see the broad-based adoption. You know, we one stat that I tell everybody is like 80% of our customers have us deployed to more than 50% of their departments. So that it's not a data engineering product, right? It's a product where IT uses us, but so does finance and HR and marketing, right? And I think that's pretty exciting, right? The idea to be, there aren't many products that have that level of sort of penetration, you know, into a user base or the amount of impact that you can have across a very sort of broad spectrum of use cases and workflows and data. That for me is super exciting. I think the application space that I mentioned earlier is also super exciting. I really do believe that we are going to see, at some level, a dismantling of the situation that you articulated, which is a bunch of investment dollars going into what I just consider to be micro ideas, you know, to try to build a company. I think that opportunity to allow end users to build applications that are really meaningful to them without having to go to technical experts, and therefore just be that much more relevant both to them as well as to their enterprises, that's super exciting. And I do think AI is exciting. I just don't think that AI that we should fear it. And I don't think that it's we're going to wake up 3 days from now and have our entire lives upended and half of us losing our jobs. You know, I really think that to your point, it's going to be, how do I make meaningful steps forward using this new technology in a way that it augments me today? And I'm going to learn from that iteration. And as I learn, and learning being the most important thing in life, right? And learning being a CAGR or a compounding effect thing, that we as a provider will learn through telemetry and what users are getting value from. Users will learn from capabilities that we give them to keep pushing the envelope. I find that super exciting because I think it's an almost limitless set of like permutations of opportunities in front of us.
Yeah. By the way, I'm with you on not seeing a dystopian future ahead of us. I mean, yeah. I've always been an eternal optimist. Satish knows this. And anytime people are surprised by that, like if I wasn't an optimist, do you really think I would have started a company? Do you think we would have started a company?
Right.
Like, yeah.
Good point.
So yeah, I'm with you there. We got time for a couple last questions, Satish. I don't know if you had anything before we wrap up. And there's also some questions from the audience too. So I want to make sure we cover
those. Just quickly on the last point that we were making, I see these two things. There is this problem space where we're trying to solve a set of problems. And then there is the technology that we have on one side, right? And we say, okay, what problems can we solve with this technology? And when the technology sometimes takes the lead, like a big leap, all the problems seem small for some time. And that's the scary part. We think we solved everything. But before you know, the problem space gets bigger and now the technology feels small. And then we have seen this over and over. And I think this phase that we are in is AI is that big leap. And the problem space sometimes feels, oh, this is small, but that gets bigger. And then the AI would fall short. So that's is how I see it, you know, just wanted to add that kind of perception.
I agree with you 100%. I like the way you describe that. I use, and I've spared you guys on this podcast, but anyone that knows me, I use tons of metaphors. and I do think a little bit about this as like the horse and the car, you know, where if all the first car users looked at was exactly the same use cases they had for horses, you know, and that they were putting horses out of job, great. But, you know, you had to come to the idea. I was like, wait a minute, I can do many different things with this car that I never even thought of doing with my horse. And I think that, again, I keep coming back to like, it's like peeling an onion, right? You iterate, you do something new, that opens up yet more opportunities. You keep going, right? And that one to many set of opportunities, to your point about being an optimist, that's what you have to be an optimist about. And that if you're passionate about it, you know, you're going to be able to, our companies are going to be able to be at the forefront of discovering what's through that next door.
Totally. We got a few minutes left. I'm going to go rapid fire with these last few questions. One of them's from the audience, Ian Waring, who also recommended a book, good Kindle book, Reshuffle, Who Wins When AI Restacks the Knowledge Economy. So thanks for the recommendation. The question is, do you expect ISVs to be building all their end user apps on Sigma or end users themselves?
Oh, I think end users themselves. My hot take prediction is really, if you're an ISV and you're not working with a deep level of knowledge with a workflow in a very, very particular and niche area, then I think you could be in trouble. And if your area is so niche, then I still think you're in trouble because the consumer of that application will know better than you and will be able to build that application. If we had a longer podcast, I could give you some really fascinating apps that have been built on Sigma that sort of go in that direction.
Well, we'll have to have you back on or do a webinar of some sorts because that would be awesome. Last couple questions. One, if you could go back in time and give yourself some career advice, what comes to mind as to what would have been the most beneficial thing that you could have told Mike Palmer 10 years ago or 20 years ago, whatever it might've been?
This is easy to say in retrospect, so it's probably not even great advice, but it's just take more risk.
I love that. Take more risk.
Yeah. Take more risk. It's the thing that I will tell my kids. And
I don't know, Satish, I'm sure you remember Ron Gout, one of our pre-seed investors. He put in a small check. We were very early stage. And he said, I never met a winner who was afraid to make a bet. So that's always stuck with me. And this was in the you know, during the pandemic, we were scared of starting this business and all the things that were to come, but I'm glad we took the risk. Last question.
Indeed.
Just some closing thoughts, you know, advice for data people in the industry. You know, if you're given the opportunity to just share a general piece of advice to anybody in the data ecosystem, what would you say would be the most important thing for them to understand?
I come back to something I mentioned before, which is like, what's the job to be done with the data, right? And I think there's a real opportunity for everyone working in the data ecosystem to look beyond the confines of what they think their role is and really think two concentric circles away from them. And I think the technology is such that they can be empowered to execute that two concentric circle expansion for themselves. And I think what they should expect is anyone that was doing that before themselves are already doing a two concentric circle expansion on what's possible. So I think this is the time where people should say, like, I'm going to really expand my remit.
I love it. Mike, it's so great having you on. Thank you so much.
It was a pleasure.
For your time. It's been a total blast. And it's a pleasure to meet you for the first time. I've got a lot of respect for you and the company.
The feeling is mutual. Love to do it again. Thank you both.